From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the Longevity Project, an eight-decade-long project studying people. It's an amazing story, and you're going to be part of it in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM next hour. Well, it's time for us to do a little mass consciousness because the drought is worsening in the Southwest. And floods are hitting the Midwest. The severe drought ravaging Texas and other parts of the Southwest, getting worse. Little hope seen for farmers, ranchers, and others whose livelihoods and properties are suffering, and suffering big time. The latest report from a consortium of national climate experts, dubbed the Drought Monitor, said that while Texas remained the epicenter for devastation, exceptional drought, which is the worst category, expanded now, not only through parts of Oklahoma, but also Kansas, New Mexico, and Louisiana, and of course, Texas. The lack of moisture, coupled with high temperatures and wind, fueled wildfires that so far have ravaged 2.2 million acres, destroying more than 1,100 buildings in Texas. Hey, what do we have to lose? Why don't you concentrate on heavy rain in Texas and the West, the rest of the Southwest, if you would? And concentrate tonight. And let's see what happens. We'll monitor this over the next couple days. Mitch Batros, he monitors all these weather changes and conditions for us. Mitch, this one's getting bad.
Getting bad. Keeping things in perspective, it was actually much, much worse in the 1930s Dust Bowl. But it does show cyclical events. When you look at a larger range of historical data, then you see that the Earth has seen this many times before and often much worse. But we are in that. And it's not just a local geographical area such as the United States. China is also experiencing a severe drought. At the same time, we have these floods, and the Mississippi River is ready to bust out. And, of course, in Missouri, they're busting another hole in a levee there. So, yes, these things can happen simultaneously. They always have. In many ways, it's not that unusual. The size and magnitude and number are unusual for our history, for our generation. Now, what is causing it? Well, on May 2nd, we had a significant geomagnetic storm. The auroras, it was so large or large enough that the aurora borealis came all the way down to south of New York in Michigan. That's pretty far south. Usually they're way up north in Canada. So it dropped way down to low latitudes. Well, another report has come out highlighting some very rare events. The title of this article from NASA is Strange Cosmic Ray Hotspots Are in Our Southern Skies. And they're specifically talking about the South Pole, and there's these bursts of cosmic rays, as they're calling them, hotspots, that they don't seem to know where it's attached.
But, Mitch, why would the Midwest, like St. Louis, get hit with so much rain over the last couple months, and then an area like Texas and Kansas and spots like that get virtually nothing?
Well, speaking of hotspots, it all has to do with ocean and jet stream currents. And as you know, George, I always go backwards. But starting with the localizing it, let's say Missouri and Oklahoma, Texas, and then you go, well, why is it? Then you look at these thunderstorms, and we're talking about all those tornadoes that happen. Well, tornadoes are caused by jet streams,
right,
and the winding of currents. Well, what stimulates that? Well, it goes and it's consistent with this, different ocean temperatures and shifting ocean currents. What stimulates that? Well, then you go into our atmosphere and upper atmosphere stratosphere, and what you finally come up with is the magnetic storms. In other words, the sun. And with this new information that just came out, plus this low latitude auroras, tells me, and I need to really bear down in my research to get confirmation from the high ups, that I think what we're witnessing is a magnetic pole shift. These are all signs that the shift is in motion. And historically what happens is the magnetic north starts to bounce around before there's a full flip. it starts to bounce around. And I think these events that we're seeing now are symptoms and signs of this event.
Well, I hope it changes, Mitch. Thank you. Mitch's website, earthchangesmedia.com. Thanks, Mitch. By the way, world food prices rose to a near record in April, as we've been saying, as grain costs advanced, adding pressure to inflation that is accelerating from Beijing to Brasilia and spurring central banks to raise interest rates. The Obama administration has floated a transportation authorization bill. Listen to this. That would require the study and implementation of a plan to tax you based on how many miles you drive. The plan is part of the administration's Transportation Opportunities Act. It is an undated draft of which was obtained this week by Transportation Weekly. The White House said the bill is only an early draft and that it was not formally circulated within the administration. But they're working on plans to tax you based on how many miles you drive. Makes no sense. General Motors reported its highest quarterly profit in more than a decade, helped by demand for fuel-efficient cars and a big gain from its selling of its stake in its former auto parts business. Cell phones sold in Chicago after January 1st would have to be equipped with a special feature that allows parents to block kids from texting while driving under a crackdown proposed by the city council. An alderman there proposed this surprise restriction at the last meeting of the old city council in an effort to stop what he calls an epidemic of sending texts while driving, much of it involving young drivers. Pakistan's army ordered a reduction in U.S. military personnel operating inside that country in an apparent protest at a unilateral American commando raid that killed Osama bin Laden. The army has been heavily criticized at home for allowing the country's sovereignty to be violated during the operation in a busy town not far from the capital of Islamabad. It is also facing international charges that it may have been harboring the Al-Qaeda chief, given his location. I can't see how they didn't know where he was, right in the middle of all these military personnel in that town. A long time ago, in a far-off place, there were what were called ancient Vedics. They were a vast number of texts of literature. Part of what it included was the strong possibility of an ancient war, a nuclear war. And in a moment, Michael Cremo joins us. Can it happen again? Michael's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. This hour, we're going to talk about Michael Cremo. He's the member of the World Archaeological Congress and European Association of Archaeologists. He is an expert in archaeological evidence for alternative theories of human origins and is a research associate in history and philosophy of science. A number of books, Forbidden Archaeology, Human Devolution, The Forbidden Archaeologist. Welcome back, a coast-to-coast favorite, Michael Cremo. Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm fine, George. Good to be with you and all your listeners again.
I thought of you today as I was doing my prep for tonight's show, and I was just thinking about Pakistan wanting to reduce our troops in its country, knowing the fact that they have an arsenal of nuclear weapons, and knowing also that I think tension there might rise because of this whole situation. I'm convinced, for example, that they knew where Osama bin Laden was, and I'm not sure we can just turn around and walk away. But I was thinking of the things we've talked about over the past several years, Michael, about the Vedics and the kind of literature that kind of hinted to a past war of a nuclear war a long time ago. Let's review that, if you could, for our listeners.
The ancient Vedic historical writings like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and the Bhagavad Purana mention huge battles that took place in the Indian subcontinent, part of which includes Pakistan today. And these writings describe the use of weapons that very much resemble modern nuclear weapons. For example, in the Mahabharata, there's a description of a weapon called the Agneya weapon. And it said when this weapon goes off, you know, there's huge flash of light. It says fierce winds blow in every direction. I've seen pictures of atomic bombs going off. The United States did test several atomic bombs above ground in the 1940s and early 1950s. And when you look at those movies, you see what appears to be a huge hurricane-like wind blowing. It's the shock wave coming out from the bomb. It's devastating. And I'm looking at one of these texts right now, and it says, men, horses, and elephants were slaughtered and burned to ashes as if caught in the final conflagration that burns the world. Tens of thousands of warriors lay on the battlefield, their bodies burned beyond recognition. It sounds exactly like the effects of a modern nuclear weapon. And actually, the scientist Robert Oppenheimer, who was in charge of the development of the atomic bomb for the American military during World War II, was also a student of the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. So he was very much aware of the descriptions of these weapons, like the Agneya weapon and the Brahmastra weapon. And he was asked, when the first atomic bomb was tested in Alamogordo, New Mexico, 1945, if this was the first atomic bomb. And he said, well, the first in modern times.
Oh, my.
And actually,
implying that there was an ancient nuclear explosion.
Yeah.
Right?
And actually, when the first atomic bomb, test atomic bomb was exploded at Alamogordo, New Mexico, he started quoting Sanskrit verses from the Mahabharata, describing a light as brilliant as thousands of suns at the same time. He was very much aware of the descriptions of these weapons resembling modern nuclear weapons that are found in these ancient Sanskrit writings, and they were used in warfare. And I just read you some of the descriptions, mm-hmm. how the battlefields are littered with tens of thousands of bodies of warriors burned beyond recognition. It's really quite astonishing, the information that's there in these ancient texts.
Michael, in the Vedic literature, are there any depictions, sketches of mushroom clouds or anything like that?
Well, it is said that when this weapon is used, a dense gloom enveloped the battlefield, which is the effect that you get when that mushroom cloud.
Mm-hmm.
During the 1980s, there was a lot of talk of nuclear winter. That would be one of the effects of so many explosions of nuclear and thermonuclear devices, that they would throw up huge clouds of ash and dust and smoke that would block the sun for long periods of time. So there is some mention of that in a text I'm looking at right now, where it describes, yes, that a dense gloom enveloped the battlefield, which would be the effect of a cloud, a mushroom cloud like that.
I mean, because what else could it be, Michael? If you ruled out anything nuclear, what else could it be?
Well, it may be something that even goes beyond, nuclear energy that we know about, but it seems the effects are very similar to the atomic weapons that modern scientists have invented. It may be possible that in ancient times they were in touch with more subtle energies. They were able to release the same types of effects, but in a different way we're doing today. There's mention of the use of mantras, which are sound vibrations that were used in ancient times to unleash these very powerful energies, which were manifest in terms of just brilliant light and blazing fire and shock waves. It's the descriptions very much resemble the modern nuclear weapons. And in the ancient Sanskrit writings, they did have a knowledge of atoms. There are very detailed descriptions of atoms, how to calculate time according to the movement of atoms, things of that sort. They did have an atomic science in ancient times. They were aware of the existence of the atom and the energy contained in the atom. So it's really quite, you know, fascinating.
Michael, is there any way to date when this might have occurred?
The text record that these battles, the most recent ones, took place about 5,000 years ago in northwestern India. There was a massive battle in which such weapons were used at a place called Kurukshetra, which is in northwestern India. And the timing of that battle is established by astronomical information. In the Mahabharata, there are descriptions of star and planet positions, which can you can use planetarium software to back calculate when there these particular configurations of stars and planets were happening. So using information like that, it's been calculated the battles, these most recent battles took place about 5,000 years ago.
And of course, you know the old saying, Michael, history sometimes repeats itself.
It does. History does repeat itself. And I mean, nuclear weapons have already been used in warfare. You know, the United States used them.
Yes.
At the end of World War II. And the very existence of them is based on the threat of using them. So I think we've been very fortunate that up to this point in time, whoever it is that has control of these weapons in different countries have decided not to use them. But that possibility is always there. It's something that we have to live with.
I find it interesting that if these were used 5,000 years ago, and if we possessed this kind of technology or something similar, it also seems to echo and match the flood of Noah in other catastrophes. I'm just wondering if it's all related, Michael.
I believe there have been periodic catastrophes that have affected human civilization on Earth over the course of the past thousands and even millions of years. Of course, that takes us into another whole topic. But the Mahabharata war was within the past 5,000 years. So we do see, if we look at even recent history, you know, the past 100 or 200 years, there have been huge wars that have taken place. World War I, World War II, then there have been other wars, and we now seem to be in an age of perpetual warfare. Wars have been going on for decades, it seems, in the Middle East, other parts of the world. It's a little reminiscent of that novel 1984.
George Orwell.
George Orwell, where he was talking about that state of permanent war. So we do seem to have entered into an era like that.
All right, Michael, I want you to stay with us. We're going to take some phone calls with you as we also talk about forbidden archaeology, incredible stories, incredible theories about the past, how ancient, how far back we really went with high technology. And it is fascinating. These Vedic texts will clearly spell out that something of incredible scope and magnitude occurred a very long time ago that many, like Michael Cremo and Robert Oppenheimer, the late Robert Oppenheimer, the developer of the atomic bomb, he believes that they had a nuclear explosion then, too. We'll be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we're going to talk about the Longevity Project, a project that started in 1921, sampling 1,500 boys and girls. It's an amazing study, and it affects all of us. When we come back, we'll talk more about forbidden archaeology with Michael Cremo and take your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. We're with Michael Cremo. Michael's website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you. Fascinating work. Michael, how long have you been doing this now?
I've been doing this since about 1984. That's when I started doing the research for my book, Forbidden Archaeology. It took me about 9 years to put that book together, but it was well worth it, I think, because of the impact it's had.
Was there one case, one episode, some event that got you into all this?
Well, what really got me into this was my encounter with the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. That's where I first stumbled on this idea that humans like us have been present on Earth for millions and millions of years, going all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. It was something completely different than I'd heard from my teachers in high school and university. So it really got me thinking about all of these questions about human origins and human antiquity. And I could see in a lot of the different ancient wisdom traditions, this idea that humans have been around for millions of years is there. So I had to think, is that just mythology, or is there perhaps some physical evidence to support it? And of course, you're not going to find any such evidence in the current textbooks of anthropology and archaeology. But I decided, okay, let me look beyond the textbooks. Let me look at the original scientific reports. And when I did that, I started finding literally hundreds of reports of scientists finding human bones, human artifacts, human footprints, millions of years old. So that's what resulted in that book, Forbidden Archaeology.
Did Oppenheimer get his idea to develop the atomic bomb from the Vedics, or was he just seeing similarities there?
I think a lot of the scientists, a lot of the physicists that were working in Europe and America at that time were investigating the Vedic literature. Niels Bohr, for example, one of the scientists that was involved in developing the nuclear energy theories,
mm-hmm.
was a great physicist. Was a student of them. A lot of them were aware of these ancient texts. What role it had exactly in their work, it's hard to say. You'd have to try to trace it out through more detailed research. But one thing is clear, they were aware of what the ancient Sanskrit writings had to say about the atom, about weapons resembling modern atomic weapons. They were aware of this. They mentioned it in their writings. How much it directly influenced the development of the modern atomic weapon, I think, is a topic for further research, but it's really suggestive.
When I think of ancient technology, Michael, I think of the movie Star Wars, the series of Star Wars movies, and the incredible technology they possessed, you know, the flying craft, the laser weapons and everything else they had, yet they all lived in stone huts. So when I think of the ancients that might have possessed this kind of technology, they don't necessarily should have had, for example, computers and flat-screen televisions, cell phones. They didn't have that, did they?
They may have had equivalents, but they may have been operating with more subtle energies. As I said, according to the ancient Sanskrit text, these weapons, like the Agneya weapon and the Brahmastra weapon, which resemble the modern nuclear weapons in terms of their effects. These were controlled by sound, by mantra. And this may seem a little unusual, but even at the present moment, we can see that sound has a lot of energy in it. There's ultrasound. You can use ultrasound for welding, for example. It can melt metals together. Ultrasound can be used for purifying, sterilizing medical instruments. Sound can be used as a weapon. There's a lot that you can do with sound, and the ancients may have had greater abilities than we presently do to manipulate sound vibration in such a way that it could unleash tremendous amounts of energy.
Yes. Let's go to Paul, Denver, Colorado, west of the Rockies. Hey, Paul, you're on with Michael Cremo. Go ahead.
Good evening, or morning, as the case may be, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Michael, I'm interested to hear more about how you think we lost the thread historically, the record.
Well, the records, Paul, have been preserved. We may have lost our understanding of how to access all of these things. And part of it has to do with the cycles of ages. According to Vedic cosmology, time goes in vast cycles. And at certain points of these cycles, humans have greater mental and intellectual capabilities. According to the Vedic cosmological calendar, we're now in a part of the cycles. It's called the Kali Yuga, where human mental and intellectual abilities are declining from their previous state, where people were able to master these more subtle energies in the universe. And now we're kind of stuck with manipulating the grosser energies and trying to duplicate powers that people once had naturally in terms of machines made of metal. For example, according to the ancient text, people naturally were able to communicate at great distances from each other telepathically, or they were able to get information about distant places through what we would now call remote viewing. And these were abilities people naturally possess. Now we try to reduplicate these things in terms of our computers and World Wide Web and handheld devices and television and things like that. So part of the problem is the succession of ages, which results in human beings having lesser abilities than they did in the distant past.
All right, very good. Thank you, Michael. Grace, Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Grace, go ahead.
Hi, nice to talk with you.
Hi, you too.
I am wondering if you have ever heard of someone who hears words in their mind and then is able to speak words and sentences that when looked up on like a interpreter turns out to be ancient Sanskrit.
Things like that do happen. Technically, it's called xenoglossy, means the ability of a person to speak a language that they've never heard before. The psychiatrist Ian Stevenson studied this phenomenon. He was particularly looking into a case of a woman in Philadelphia who started speaking an ancient dialect of the Swedish language, and she had never studied Swedish. She had, but scholars who understood this ancient Swedish dialect were able to understand, you know, what she was saying. So I think that could also happen in terms of manifesting an ability to speak Sanskrit. There are cases like this from India where people in India manifest an ability to speak some other Indian dialect, not the one that is spoken in the area where they're born. Sometimes in Christian circles, there's the phenomenon of speaking in tongues and things of that sort. So, yes, I do think things like that can happen. They do happen.
Okay, next up, we go to Honolulu. It's Jason's turn. Hey, Jason, go ahead.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for your contribution to humanity. My main question is if you think that Krishna might have been an alien if he was blue.
Well, for those who aren't familiar, Krishna is Hindu god. It's a name for God in
right.
the ancient Sanskrit language. I would say we're all aliens in this sense, that is, beings, conscious beings, we have an origin from a level of pure consciousness in the cosmos. That is where we originally exist as conscious beings. So we are all aliens in that sense. In Hindu thought, in Hindu religion, cosmology, theology, there's the concept of avatars. Of course, there was that film, Avatar.
That's right. They're all blue.
Where a soldier's consciousness is projected into another planet, into a body on another planet. So this word avatar comes from the Sanskrit language. It's used, it means one who descends or comes down from one level of the cosmos to another. So in that sense, yes, Krishna would be an avatar, an alien, in the sense that, well, and we're all aliens in that sense, that our original existence is not from this level of the cosmos. It's not from this earth. We have an origin at some other higher level of the cosmos from which we've descended.
And, okay.
Yes.
Go ahead, no, I'll let you finish up.
So periodically, according to this way of thinking, there are higher beings who descend from that higher level to remind us of our original position. They're called avatars, and Krishna is one of them.
Just remarkable. I mean, just the study of what might have happened a long time ago. Absolutely riveting. Let's go to Michael in Anderson, Indiana. Hi, Michael, first-time caller. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Michael, sir, how are you?
Good to have another Michael on.
Yeah, my mother named me Michael for a reason, and you probably know what that is. anyway, I'm kind of nervous about this. I listen to you, Georgia, a lot, and I've always hesitated about calling in, but listening to your guest tonight, I decided to take a chance, and they answered right away.
Perfect.
So it's great. And I'll be really brief about this. I don't have any questions. I just feel compelled to reiterate everything Michael's saying, but I want to take it to another level. These wars, ancient wars, that are probably at least millions of years old here on Earth, I believe they happened all over the solar system myself. I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but my mother, she only went to the seventh grade. She was, and her and my grandparents were sharecroppers.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother did teach me how to read and write when I was 3 years old. And from 3.5 to 5 years old, I have 203 notebooks that I wrote. I keep in my safe. I call myself an amateur theologian.
At that age, too, that's remarkable.
Ancient history, philosopher, all that. And the reason I say amateur is because I'm an information junkie, but I don't have the credentials to prove it.
Well, let me ask you this, Michael. Why do you believe that, and I agree with you, but why do you believe ancient civilizations are that old?
Well, it's just, I don't know how, it's hard for me to explain how I know this. I've read the Bible probably 100 times over, and lots of ancient history. Like I said, I'm an information junkie. I'm at the library 24/7. I sleep about 3 hours every 24 hours, and I don't watch TV. I listen to your show and classical music, and I'm always in a book. But like, take Mars. I think, and a lot of my knowledge is not just from my own. I do have an associate's degree in liberal arts, but that's nothing. You know, in high school and college, I was just bored silly. But like, take Mars. I kind of got the feeling we probably started out on Mars because, and a lot of my studies or my knowledge comes from just plain revelation from the one creator. Now, I'm not, now there's one, I believe there's one creator, but I believe there's other higher beings and forces in the universe also.
Sure.
But Mars was bigger, and there was probably about, I'm going to guess at one time, 30 billion humans on Mars before these wars broke out.
Well,
Mars was totally Mars was totally devastated, and the people that survived, or whoever helped us survive, made the Earth. I don't know how to really say this. Made the Earth in a form that we could survive on.
Well, that's very possible. Let me get your take on this, if I can. Michael, he's pretty close, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's got some really good insights there. First of all, his idea that the wars that took place in ancient times were interplanetary. That's something that is described in a lot of different ancient wisdom traditions. It's certainly there in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. There are descriptions of vimanas or spacecraft that were used in battles between the different forces in the universe. So that's a fact. I also believe, along with the caller, Michael, that human-like life forms are present not only all over our solar system, but throughout the entire galaxy, throughout the entire universe. According to the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, there are 400,000 human-like species scattered throughout the entire cosmos. And if we really start looking at the whole range of reports, of not just the ancient astronaut reports, the ancient aliens reports, but the modern reports of UFOs and aliens and things of that sort, I think we can see pretty clearly that we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings. So I think the caller, Michael, there is onto some things, yes.
I think so, too. Michael, your latest, are you working on another one?
Well, what I'm working on now, well, of course, my latest book is The Forbidden Archaeologist, but what I'm doing now is I'm putting together a book of all the papers I've presented at mainstream scientific conferences over the past few years. I'm going to take about 25 of those papers that I've presented at meetings of the World Archaeological Congress, European Association of Archaeologists.
And compile them.
And I'm going to compile them into a book because I want people to know that these things are being discussed, not just on Coast to Coast, which is a really great place to discuss them, but also at these mainstream scientific
You get that ready, Michael. You come back for a full program. Michael Cremo up next. We talk about the Longevity Project. Stand by on Coast to Coast AM.